You're out of order. I'd like to call a mobile source committee meeting to order for today would be the 25th of October. The roll, please.
On the roll for the mobile source committee meeting of October 25th, 2018, Director Avi Coca, Director Cutter, Director Groom, Board Chair Hudson,
here.
Director Ju, Director Kim, Director Miley, Director Mitchoff, here. Director Sparing, Committee Vice Chair Canepa,
here.
Committee Chair Haggerty.
Here.
We are one short of a quorum.
Thank you. Story of my life. Canepa, lead.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Do you know all the words?
Mine a little slower.
Jeez, no, I like it a little piffy. You should hear me when I sing happy birthday. All right, public comment, a time in which you can speak to anything that is not on today's agenda. I have no speaker cards. I'm assuming you do neither there, Marcy. Okay, so with that, I think we have to move all the way down to item six, update on vehicle infrastructure and fleet, because there will be no action there.
Good morning, Chair Haggerty and members of the committee.
This morning,
Mark Tang, our staff specialist, will lead us through this presentation. This is to give us a view of where we are relative to our infrastructure and to talk in the region and numbers of vehicle adoption. It leads into the electric vehicle, the rolling electric vehicle presentation that we've been having over the last few months. And we'll also talk to you about two programs that we're very excited about relaunching. So Mark will take us to the presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Damien. Good morning, Chair Haggerty and members of the Mobile Source Committee.
Good morning.
My name is Mark, as Damien just mentioned, and I work in the Technology Implementation Office. So I run some of the light-duty EV programs here at the Air District. So I want to give some updates on where we're at with our EV adoption in the Bay Area. As many of you know, we do have a goal in our 2017 Clean Air Plan to transition at least 90% of the Bay Area's fleet to zero emission vehicles by 2050. And our current adoption, we have about 125,000 EVs on Bay Area roads, which comprises a little over 2% of our fleet. So we are doing pretty well, as you can see on the graph at the bottom there. We are above our Bay Area goal, which is that dotted line, but we'll have to aggressively really ramp up some of our efforts in order to meet that 90% goal by 2050. So this map shows a heat map, basically, of EV adoption in the Bay Area. I think some of you may have seen this before, but generally the point is that most of our adoption is happening in the South Bay and Peninsula and some pockets in the North Bay and some in the East Bay. So we do recognize that there is a blank spot there on the East and North, and we'll have to focus a little more efforts in those areas as we move forward. And jumping over to the infrastructure side of the equation here, this chart shows our range of expected needed infrastructure in the Bay Area to meet our EV goals. And so you can see here we have about 6,600 publicly accessible chargers in the Bay Area, but that's at the very low end of our expected goals, the range. So the range comprises of a number of different scenarios that we'll need to meet in terms of EV adoption. So we don't want to be at the low end there. We want to definitely be at least in the middle or higher. And moving forward, we'll have to, again, increase our efforts in this area too. So I'm going to run through this slide really quickly because I know there are some other presentations that following that will go into a little more detail on the Transportation Fund for Clean Air, and you, most of you are familiar with this. It is a DMV surcharge, a $4 surcharge on registrations in the Bay Area. And for fiscal year 2019, we have approximately 20, that number may change a little bit. For this year. And I'll be speaking more specifically for the two programs, the Charge and Clean Fleets program, which falls into the Clean Vehicle and Infrastructure bucket. So jumping into the CHARGE program, this program has been in existence for the last 3 or 4 years, and the goal of it is to rapidly expand publicly accessible EV charging stations in the Bay Area and transition our fleet away from fossil fuels. The CHARGE program is open to public and private organizations, so individual residences are not eligible to apply. And we do encourage co-location of clean energy production such as solar panels and multi-port stations, and also to increase the amount of DC fast charging along major transportation corridors in the Bay Area. I'm happy to announce that we did launch the CHARGE program for fiscal year 2019 today. So it's live, and we are concurrently doing some webinars now with some prospective applicants. And so this is a map of our impact in terms of our investment into charging infrastructure in the Bay Area. This is over the last 10 years we've been active in funding publicly accessible charging stations. And so it's a little difficult to see on here, but the blue dots represents the chargers that we've actually invested in over the years, and that comprises about 36% of all the publicly accessible chargers in the Bay Area. So we've done quite a lot in terms of that efforts, and we'll continue to do so. These are some metrics of the CHARGE program from the previous fiscal year. So we were able to award over $6.5 million in TFCA funding, which supported the installation of over 2,000 EV charging stations. I do want to point out some of the facility types that we were able to get chargers into. As you can see, most of our chargers went into workplace and destinations, and those typically comprised of level 2 chargers, which are appropriate for that type of facility type where people are dwelling for long periods of time. We did get some in some DC fast chargers in the transportation corridor, but not a lot. And our efforts going forward will be to try to increase chargers in apartment complexes or multi-dwelling units. That's been a challenging facility for us, but we hope that we can formulate the CHARGE program in a way that promotes more adoption in those facility types. So this is what the fiscal year 2019 CHARGE program looks like, which has opened today. We've kept the funding levels very similar to the previous year because we've heard from many people that they were adequate, well, not adequate, but they were good enough, and we didn't want to reduce them. So we've kept those the same. In terms of the plus-ups I mentioned earlier, we've also kept those the same. So we still have the solar, multi-port, and transportation corridor plus-ups. And this year, we were able to include a new plus-up called the multi-dwelling unit plus-up, which should help us increase our penetration into that category. So it's $4,000 per charger if those projects are located at a multi-dwelling unit. So again, today we opened the CHARGE program, and that program will be open until June 30th, 2019, or until funds are exhausted sooner. There is currently $5 million allocated to this program. And so jumping over to the vehicle side, we did launch the Clean Fleets program in August 2018, and this program is to provide funding to purchase or lease new light-duty vehicles, zero-emission light-duty vehicles. So that includes motorcycles and anything from a pickup truck to a small van. And we do allow electric or hydrogen fuel cell vehicles as part of this program. And there's a 10-vehicle minimum to participate. And again, you can purchase or lease these vehicles. We are focusing this program on the different categories listed up on this slide here. So ride-hail, car-share, or transportation network companies, some municipal and private fleets, and also police and parking agencies here in the Bay Area. And the website is on there, so feel free to distribute this to your networks. And so I wanted to go over some of the outreach activities that we've conducted and to support our programs here. As with all our TFCA programs, we always do email notifications and maintain a communication with some of our stakeholders. We've also leveraging some of our social media efforts here. So we're doing Facebook posts, LinkedIn, and some Twitter's posts to advertise these programs. We've continued and will continue to participate in ride-in drives with various counties and cities and nonprofit organizations here in the Bay Area. We found that that's been a really effective way to really get out there and get the message across that EVs exist to different communities that aren't aware that there is there are a range of EV options available. We will also be contacting associations and different organizations to get newsletters out to different stakeholders and different groups, specifically kind of the multi-dwelling unit area. We can contact different organizations that work in that space and get that word out there too. And I did put on here transportation network companies and car rental agency organizations. I do want to point out that this is kind of on our map. We are looking at it. Transportation network companies provide a slightly difficult situation because they don't own any vehicles, but we do need to work with them because we understand that they have a lot of influence in driving where their drivers or where their what kind of vehicles their drivers are buying. So we want to definitely work with them to try to transition that fleet to zero emissions. So that concludes my presentation today. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Colleagues, first of all, I'd like to thank you for letting them get through the slide presentation before you started jumping in on questions. But Director Mitchoff has been patient.
Thank you. Great report and very helpful. On the outreach efforts, back on slide 11, you've got associations and newsletters. Did I hear you say homeowners associations? Or?
No, I did not specifically call it homeowners associations. But we have previously had applicants in homeowners associations, so they do qualify for the charge program. And we're happy to talk to other homeowners.
And I appreciate that because I know how hard it is to get a list of homeowners associations. And so if you had one, I would like to have you share it with us. And I see you also have fleet organizations. Are you sending these to also city managers and county administrators? When you talk about fleet and when you were looking at where the focus was, a lot of that, you've had great success with the ride sharing and those types of things, but for that, I was just curious that they were also on the list.
So we do maintain a list, a general list that people can sign up for, and I believe a lot of the city managers or fleet managers are actually on that list. We also do work with some organizations like the Clean Cities Coalition to work with them and get the word out on in terms of our program, but we'd be happy to.
I appreciate that. I know it's a lot of work, mm-hmm. but with ABAG in the building, they've got those contacts, and I would I think that would help make your job easier if you could work with them. Thank you
Certainly,
very much.
Certainly, thank you.
Yeah, I'm excuse me, I was looking at slide two, and it came to me that probably another group that should be getting this information is your business parks that are doing the commuter benefit. We should have them on the email list already. What really caught my attention is I look at 2% at 125,000 EVs. And just rounding off up or down or whatever, we're looking at 10 million vehicles in 2050, plus or minus, and 9 million will be electric. That's a lot of charging. I'd be getting some information if I were building a parking lot right now.
Just a couple questions. What goes into the planning around the infrastructure? Like, how do you identify different opportunities? Because one of the slides you had said, if you could bring that slide up with the different percentages.
Is it this one?
Yeah. So, you know, you have workplace 61%, destination 29%, apartments, transit parking, transportation quarter. How do you, when you think about this planning, you think about electric vehicle scaling. Mm-hmm. What goes into sort of the thinking, the methodology? Walk me through the process a little.
So I think ultimately...
So, in starting down this road, we developed a region-wide plan for the deployment of electric vehicles. And in that plan, we looked at, you know, target corridors based on number of vehicles, where the vehicles were being bought. One of the things that makes, you know, action difficult in this space for government is that there are also a number of others who are working in this area. So one of the things that we've done in this region is we've set up a coordinating council that's run by ourselves and MTC. And that allows us to coordinate with efforts like the VW program, Electrify America, which is a mandated by court program that is going to install chargers in both impacted communities and throughout the region. Before them, we had to work with the NRG program, which again had stipulated and mandated goals, and PG&E have a program. So in our coordination efforts and in our planning, we look at where they are going to install their charging as best we can and talk to them about that. And with our, because we don't have the scale of resources that they have, we look where we can have the most impact. And you can see that in general, what our planning has identified, the two most important areas outside of home charging are the workplace and destination charging. Also very important are apartment complexes, but it has been very difficult for us to crack that. We've developed guidance along with other parties throughout the state. We've worked with, you know, homeowners associations. We've done extensive outreach there. It's just that those projects tend to be very difficult to do because of issues with, I own this parking space, or we have to share parking spaces. Who gets the electrification? Is the cost of the upgrade on the homeowner? Those types of things. So in planning, we factor in all of those, and our programs are targeted at filling the gaps, essentially.
So as we were going through the slides, when we got to slide 9, and you're showing the amount of the charges, how much we'll give as a grant, what I don't know is how much a DC fast charger costs.
It is dependent, but the cost of them have come down. They used to be in the hundreds of thousands, but now they're in the, you know, 15, 20, 35. The real cost with DC fast charging is the associated infrastructure, getting transformers, doing underground trenching and some of those issues. So we give a good sized grant towards the charger itself. It's the other costs. So this roughly, you know, on average across makes up, you know, somewhere between 20 to 50% of the cost of.
Okay, I just hope that's enough. And then one of the other questions I wanted to ask, is there a law that requires that you build so many charging systems when you build some sort of development? So that's already in place?
Yeah, the California Green Code, which is adopted by most cities, has a mandate.
That's not a law.
Well, it's actually adopted.
Is it a requirement such as handicaps? The amount, so... You have to put in so many handicap spots based on the amount of people that will be living there or working there.
Yeah.
Is there that law that says you have to build so many charging stations for the amount of people that live or work there? Or is it up to the city to adopt it and then it becomes a law?
Yeah, the CalGreen standard that went into effect, I believe, in 2017 actually does mandate a limited number of chargers, and it is based off the size of the facility that's being built and the number of parking spots. But it also does require more extensive make-readies, which is all the conduit, and really what Damien was just talking about with DC fast chargers, it's really what is usually the most expensive part of the project requires a much more extensive upgrading or preparedness for that, so that in the future, as the cars come, it's very inexpensive to just put a charger on top and make that connection. So that's something that for new construction,
There is a mechanism, a legislative mechanism in place through the state that all new construction will follow this. Really, what we'll be working with probably over the long term is going back with all the remodels and existing build out. So for the future, there's hope.
I'd also add that individual cities and counties have adopted more aggressive targets than are required. There is ordinance and other guidance out there if folks are interested in even more significant targets.
So the slide, I don't think, the slide on page 8, the transit parking, what is in that? What do you mean by transit parking?
So parking rides, basically.
So it is parking rides.
Mm-hmm, correct.
Okay, that's the question I was going to get at. And then I think a slide for me that would be helpful, and maybe for my colleagues, is to see which counties are using these. What I mean by that is, you know, you're saying that you want municipal and private fleets. Director Mitchoff was inquiring about, you know, the county side of it. Almost all of Alameda County's fleet is electric, almost all of it, except for some of the heavy-duty public works stuff. But I don't know how much they're utilizing Air District grants. And I would like to know. So it would, I think a follow-up maybe to the committee would inform us how much each county is using the Air District grants, if they are even. And I would hope, based on the amount of EVs that we have at Alameda County, that they're using your grants. Because if not, I need to have a very strong discussion with the GSA director.
Actually, you mentioned GSA. I was going to mention them too. That agency is actually one of the first and largest participators in our program. So
in Alameda County
specifically. I mean, there's other cities within Alameda County that have also been very active, but specifically I would call out Alameda County, and I would also call out Sonoma County, just as an example of two counties that have been applying for grants for almost 10 years for EV, I would say 8 or 9 years. So we could also later this year provide an update, or early next year as well.
I think my colleagues would want to see is a pie chart that shows Alameda County getting, you know, 40% of the available charging money, Sonoma's getting 10, and the rest of them are all splitting 50% of it, and maybe Contra Costa's only getting 5%. I think my colleagues would like to see that so they can go back and have a discussion with whoever's in charge of their purchasing. And then one of the requirements that you had on there is that you needed to purchase a minimum of 10 vehicles. In a purchase or lease, can they use any car dealership of their choice, or do we have to jump into the state requirements? Or
no, we've made that deliberately flexible. One of the things we have done is that they have their own options for procurement there. I also wanted to give Alameda County credit because when they did come forward and procure their electric vehicles, they left their procurement open. So any other jurisdiction and or city or county can join and get the same pricing and leasing as they've got.
Well, I know we have a hell of a price on Bolts, and that seems to be what we're buying most of right now. So, okay, Director Mitchoff.
As a follow-up to that, I just sent an email to my county administrator because we're building a new parking structure, and I know there's EV in it, so if they didn't apply, I want them to see about retroactive. Do we have any criteria? Where I'm going with this, when you talk about the DC, which I assume is the fast charging, so if a multi-unit complex comes in and they want the slower chargers, do we have any ability to say you really ought to be thinking about the fast chargers? Because you just mentioned that point earlier, it's that shared parking, who gets to park there longest, and if we own, you know, I know we can't prohibit it, but if they don't understand and perhaps want to put that in there, so that they don't have problems in the future with those who live there. And I'm speaking because I live in a condo, and there are a number of open spaces near a joint area. But if somebody's parking there overnight, because I was talking to Supervisor Rice from the other day, and she just bought a Bolt. She got the DC charger, but at her house it isn't set up yet, and she only gets like 50 miles if she charges overnight. So it would seem if we're investing in this that we should be encouraging these multi-unit places to go for the DC as opposed to the slow charger. Again, that might be something to look into, or that in future grants, higher points are given to businesses or homeowners associations or whatever who apply for the DC grant as opposed to the slower charger. Thank you.
I think that's something we need to look into, because these were the DC chargers were a lot more expensive in the past. It didn't make as much sense to look at that. So let us look at some of the guidance that we have and talk with some of the other folks in the industry and come back to you on whether or not that's something we think is a good idea.
Anybody else? No? Director Kim.
Thanks. I agree with everything that people have talked about with regard to apartments. There's just no way we're going to get to that level of penetration without cracking that nut. So whether it's higher incentives, we're going to have to find creative ways to break through in multifamily. So question about the DC fast charge. When your best option for getting a fast charge is going to a Whole Foods, something's not working, right? So two questions. Number one, why has Whole Foods found a way to pay for all of the... Is that it? Number one. And number two, my public works director says that, I've said, why haven't we tapped into these grants? And he said the same thing, that to get DC fast charging grants or any kind of grants, level two, that the district doesn't pay for transformer or conduit costs. Is that true? Are we only paying for the charger? And if so, why don't we open up eligibility to some of the other costs that are really the barrier?
So two things. I want to address the Whole Foods issue, and then also just your question on what costs are eligible. Upgrades to power system are typically very eligible. We have been very flexible in what kinds of costs are potentially covered for infrastructure. The issue is that if a specific site requires really significant capacity improvements, it's probably not a cost-effective exact location, or they'll need a different solution. Maybe fast charging isn't appropriate given the cost to upgrade and maintain that kind of power for that location. So maybe it's a good site for level one charging that would be perfect for cars that are parking for a longer dwell time. And that really has a lot, the dwell time really is what drives what kind of charging is appropriate for a location. It's possible to have a mix. You mentioned Whole Foods. Circling back to that, Whole Foods was actually a customer early on, so maybe 4 or 5 years ago. Damien mentioned NRG, which brands under the EVgo charger. So if you see an EVgo charger, it's very likely in the state of California that that was installed by NRG at their cost as part of a court-ordered settlement agreement. So that's why they're at Whole Foods, at Walgreens, at a bunch of places that NRG strategically went and formed partnerships with early on. So that's really the issue. And I would also like to just respectfully offer that DC fast charging at Whole Foods is actually really ideal. I do it often because fast charging is really only meant to be like a 30-minute session. After 30 minutes, the rate of charge is very slow. And so at that point, you're kind of using up a resource that you'd be better off on a level two charger at that point, quite frankly. So it's really ideal to park the car, get into the charger, run into Whole Foods, do your errands, be motivated to get out of there quickly, come back and your car is at least 50% charged, and you're ready to go.
So if I understand you, Karen, then whatever led to Whole Foods being able to make this huge investment was sort of a one-shot deal. It's not something that can be replicated. And then just to confirm, so cities or other folks that want to invest in DC fast charging, they could request funding for transformer upgrades. It's just not going to be as cost effective.
Well, our grant is a flat rate, so you get whatever that is. You get the $18,000, you spend it on whatever you want, as long as it's part of that particular upgrade. So one of the things I do want to stress, though, is, you know, in our guidance to cities and counties, DC fast charge is a great idea for their own home fleets. We don't advise cities and counties to get into the charging business. There are other ways that you can spend those resources, like ensuring that you're permitting, that you can give somebody a permit for a charger in an hour, that it's over the counter. That's where we've asked cities and counties to spend that resource rather than getting into the charging business, because later on down the line, these things need to be maintained, they need to be upgraded. If the technology changes, all of that falls back on cities and counties.
We're done.
No, we're not.
Director Hudson again.
Yeah, I think we're missing something here. And that's why I was looking at the parking lots to begin with. The slow charging, you can get more of them out. You just heard that Supervisor Rice said she can't get more than 50 miles charging. Is she going to drive 50 miles the next day? And she may have only been down 50 miles in where her charging is. But if you're at work, you're parked for 6, 8, 10, 12 hours. And we should be looking at a parking lot that is completely set up for every space. I go back to number two, 2050, 90% of the vehicles are expected to be electric vehicles. So you go to your parking lots where Whole Foods is or any shopping center, and you imagine that 90% of those spaces are now filled with electric vehicles. And especially with the Elix charging program and some of these others, that's where we need to be looking for, as if every space had to be electric, not just special ones, because the transition's coming soon.
Okay. So I do think it's interesting we have this discussion on a day in which the charges in our own building isn't working, or they are not working. I needed a charge and was disappointed when I walked up to the chargers and they were completely blank, but that's, I'm sure, not the Air District's fault. Construction of some sort.
And a construction truck was in one of the parking spots, too.
Yes, but he's not an EV.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, okay. So, with that, I'll you run your meeting, I'll run mine.
Just a note on that, Chair. The chargers are down this morning because the rest of the electrical charging infrastructure that we've been requesting is going in on the Harrison Street garage at long last. So they should be up by noon. So we're finally getting the charging upstairs where we need it.
Well, if I run out, I'll call you. With that, I will go to the approval of the minutes of September 27th.
So moved.
Moved by Mitch Hoff, seconded by Kim. Any objection to the motion? Motion passed without objection. We'll go to item 4, projects and contracts with proposed grant awards over $100,000.
Okay, and good morning again. Chair Haggerty and members of the Mobile Source Committee. I'm very pleased to introduce Monty DePalma, who has joined us this past year at the Air District and will be leading us through this presentation, Projects and Contracts with Proposed Awards Over $100,000.
Welcome.
Thank you, Karen, and good morning, Chair Haggerty and members of the Mobile Source Committee. Today, I'll present to you Agenda Item 4, Projects and Contracts with Proposed Grant Awards Over $100,000. As part of this presentation, I will provide background information on the district's grant programs, describe the proposed projects with awards over $100,000, update the committee on the status of funding awarded and available to date, and conclude with recommendations. The Air District has participated in the Carl Moyer Program in coordination with the California Air Resources Board since it was created in 1998. The program is voluntary and aims to reduce emissions from heavy-duty engines with funding available to both public and private entities. The Mobile Source Incentive Fund is the Air District's funding source authorized by AB 923, which allows the Air District to collect an additional $2 DMV surcharge fee. These fees can be used to fund eligible Carl Moyer program projects. The Community Health Protection Grant Program, authorized by AB 134, appropriated $250 million from the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund to reduce mobile source emissions in AB 617 communities throughout the state. Of these funds, $50 million was allocated to the Air District. The AB 134 funds are used to augment the district's Carl Moyer program and to fund on-road truck projects under the Prop 1B program. In February of this year, the Board of Directors approved participation in year 20 of the Carl Moyer program and authorized the executive officer to execute contracts and amendments with grant awards up to $100,000. In December of 2017, the Board of Directors approved the acceptance of the $50 million in AB 134 funding. For your consideration today are three Carl Moyer program projects, which will reduce emissions from 6 pieces of agricultural equipment, 26 trucks, and 2 marine engines. Staff is proposing awards totaling $909,896 for these projects, which are expected to reduce over 2.5 tons of criteria pollutants per year. More information on these projects is available in Attachment 1, Table 1 of the staff report. The Transportation Fund for Clean Air, or TSCA, is the district's oldest source of grant funding. Statutory authority and requirements for the program are set forth in the California Health and Safety Code. Funds come from a $4 surcharge on DMV registrations, with 60% of the funds awarded directly to the Air District. The remaining 40% of the funds are passed through to our 9 counties as part of the County Program Manager Fund. TFCA provides funding for on-road vehicle projects that reduce criteria emissions from light and heavy-duty vehicles and for projects that implement trip reduction services. In May of this year, the Board of Directors approved allocations of $20.44 million of TFCA funds for fiscal year ending 2019 projects and authorized the executive officer to execute contracts and amendments with grant awards up to $100,000. In June of this year, the Board of Directors adopted policies and evaluation criteria for the fiscal year ending 2019 program. For your consideration today are 4 TFCA projects, which will support 21 shuttle routes connecting commuters to mass transit and a ride-sharing program at the San Jose State University. Staff is proposing total awards of $1,852,100 for these projects, which is expected to reduce 22.7 tons of criteria pollutants per year. More information on these projects is available in Attachment 1, Table 2 of the staff report. Now I'd like to provide you with an overview of fiscal year ending 2019 awarded and available funds. This slide provides a summary of the total grant revenues for fiscal year ending 2019, broken down by grant program and totaling $137 million, which is a significant boost in revenues from previous years. Here we see a summary of grant totals awarded by category since July of this year, totaling $16.5 million. A list of these projects is included in Attachment 2 and 3 of the staff report. Here we see a distribution of the awards by county since July of this year.
There's one of your answers.
This slide shows the status of incentive funding by funding source. The section in blue represents funding already awarded. The sections in yellow represent approximately $2.75 million in funding that is being recommended for awards today, and the sections in green represent the remaining funds available for award. Also, the number below each circle graph is the amount of each funding source remaining. The fourth circle graph shows funds that pass through or that are not yet available but are expected to come online later this year. These graphs are also available on the top of Attachment 4 of the staff report. Here we have a list of open and upcoming solicitations and the amount of funds remaining or available for each. The solicitations in green are currently available and have approximately $44 million available combined. And the solicitations in blue are coming soon with approximately $12 million available combined. In closing, staff requests that the committee recommend that the Board of Directors approve recommended projects with proposed grant awards over $100,000 as shown in Attachment 1 of the staff report, and authorize the executive officer to enter all necessary agreements with the with the applicants for the recommended projects. This concludes my presentation, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Questions? So I have a question because I'm just trying to figure this out, and I apologize because I'm sure everybody here knows this, but Agenda 4, Attachment 3, when you say evaluated between, these are eligible projects but are not funded yet?
So Attachment 3, what it shows is all of the projects that have been awarded this fiscal year, including the ones that are over 100,000 that are before you today that were presented by Monty earlier, that are over 100,000. So you see those in terms of when you see board approval date, it shows as pending at the bottom.
The other projects that are under 100,000 are approved by your delegation to the executive officer. So these are projects that either are pending or have already been approved.
So I'm curious, not that I want to defund it, just curious, of this Pleasanton Connector Shuttles, what is that project? The San Joaquin Regional Rail Commission applied for those funds?
Correct.
Curious, let me get my question.
Yes.
Did they have an Alameda County sponsor along with them? You may go.
Sorry. thank you.
No, yeah. Just eager to answer the question.
Yeah, they work very closely with LAFTA, so that is the project. We've been funding that. I don't know the exact period of time, but I suspect more than 5 years, if not longer than that. Its name changes. It's the 53 and the 54 route, I believe.
Okay, so these are just simply bus routes.
These are bus routes.
Okay,
correct.
I got it then.
Feeder shuttle.
Okay, that's fine.
Service routes.
Because yeah. I think we call it something different in other places. For example, we call it the ACE Shuttle Bus Program for Santa Clara. And had we done that for Alameda County, I would know exactly what that was. But I do now know what it is. Thank you for that wonderful answer. I really appreciate it and your enthusiasm of wanting to answer the question. Anybody else?
I have a quick question, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. In the money that's allocated for the school buses, it's $7.5 million. Those, I would assume those are private bus companies like Laidlaw or Michaels, or no?
Actually, the vast majority of those are going to be public buses. Currently, our funds mainly can only, for replacement of buses, can only be used for public agencies. And so the larger awards really, so the vast majority, if not all of this funding, is for public, publicly owned buses, school buses.
Well, you know, one of my friends owns one of the bus companies. I'm curious. But you do, how do you work with private bus companies? You do work with private.
So we do. And historically, we are able to provide, historically, we've been able to provide funding for retrofit devices. So we've retrofit, thousands of privately owned retrofit devices. I do want to make a little pitch for a different VW program than what Damian was referring to earlier that is going to be doing extensive EV infrastructure deployment. There's going to be VW funds that are going to launch next calendar year, and there's a bus category for zero-emission buses. It's $130 million in project funds that will be available to provide funding for zero-emission school, transit, and shuttle buses. And in that case, I believe up to 75% of the cost of a privately owned bus would be eligible. So that is going to be a great program to help private businesses that have sort of been stuck in the diesel chain to potentially go after those projects, after that funding.
Yeah, and Ms. Mischoff brought up a good point. A lot of these bus companies do provide, private companies do provide services to different school districts, and that's why, you know, that's why I wanted to ask that that question. Thank you.
Director Hudson.
I try to get this out with a straight face. Our county has a contracted school service. They use Thomas buses, yellow, meet all the CHP, little hippity dips, privately done. I can't remember the first student or whoever does it. And we've been asking about this, they've been asking me, is this under this program that you're talking about? And they use the full 40-foot Thomas buses.
Yeah, so they will be eligible for the VW program going forward. How the state has approached this is that because this is a regulatory mandate for these school buses to clean up, they've concentrated in their regulatory adoption on about a 10% of the mandated compliance coming from grants. And that 10% was concentrated on what was the public fleet. So they've concentrated on cleaning up the public fleet and basically have had an industry, like First Student, clean up their own buses. But going forward, they want to really push the electric bus out there. So they are, through the VW program, going to provide that eligibility.
Okay. And what is their range? Because now I'm into the same problem Katie had with hers.
Yeah.
It's 50 miles there.
No, these are 100-mile plus buses.
Okay.
So they should be able to handle the duty cycle pretty easily. And we've seen a lot of our public school bus programs actually coming forward for electrics now. So that technology is there.
Okay.
The average school bus does about 40 miles or so. And then it's parked during the daytime. So it's really good if you can combine it with solar and other resources. We'll be providing some of those grants. And then other grants are being provided by PG&E and others to cover parts of the infrastructure.
Okay, thank you.
So, you know, this may be going back to the previous item, but since you brought up electric buses, things like that, when somebody's applying for, say, a charging station for, like, a bus, I'll try to keep it germane to this item, do we give them plus points if they're using solar?
So we do in the light-duty program that Mark was presenting earlier. There is a plus-up for solar, and that's something that the board did approve a couple years ago now. We don't have that mechanism in the sort of medium heavy duty program, but that's a really interesting idea, and we could definitely take it back on the TFCA side. It's not something that we could quickly or easily interject into the state funded or state guidelined programs like the Carl Moyer and the MSIF funding, but we certainly could take a look at that. We're going to be coming back in February to do some stakeholder workshops on the TFCA policies for 2020. And we'd be glad to take a look to see if that's something that we could include, because going forward, I think that's could be a really interesting idea to explore.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy enough to park these buses under big canopies of solar. So, and now with the advent of battery power, things like that, and a lot of those are actually sitting during the day anyways, especially in the school bus program, because once they take the kids to school or bring them home, they're done. Or they're running field trips to the Air District or something. Okay.
And
so with that, I am looking for a motion on item 4.
Make a motion to adopt item 4.
Moved by Director Canepa. Huh? You have a question?
No.
Second by Chairman Hudson. Is there any objection to the motion? Motion passed without objection. We will move to item 5.
Okay. And for item 5, I'm very pleased to introduce Linda Hui, who leads the County Program Manager program. She is the liaison on behalf of the Air District with the 9 county congestion management agencies to participate in this program. This is exciting in that it is kind of the first step in getting ready for fiscal year ending 2020. It kind of makes my eyes hurt a little bit, but we are getting ready for that, and Linda is going to lead us through a presentation to talk about the updates that we're proposing to the existing policies.
Okay, thanks, Karen. Good morning, Chair Haggerty and members of the Mobile Source Committee. During this presentation, I will provide a background on the Transportation Fund for Clean Air, or TFCA program, present the process of developing the proposed changes to the County Program Manager Fund policies for fiscal year ending 2020, and a summary of those updates. Present a policy waiver request from the San Francisco County Transportation Authority, and conclude with staff's recommendation. As mentioned in the previous presentation, the TFCA program is funded by a $4 motor vehicle registration fee. You just heard about the 60% TFSA portion. This presentation focuses on the 40% TFSA portion that are passed through funds to the 9 Bay Area congestion management agencies or county program managers. Each year, the Air District distributes about $9 million in funding to the county program managers. The Air District's Board of Directors adopts policies for the County Program Manager Fund, which are used by the county program managers to award TFCA funds to eligible projects within their respective counties. Today, I will be presenting the proposed updates to the fiscal year ending 2020 policies for your consideration. So we had a 8-month public input process. Starting in February this year, we met with the county program managers to collect feedback and suggestions for updating the policies. On July 27th, we formally issued the draft updates to the county program managers for them to solicit comments from stakeholders in their respective counties. Following that, we had 3 more work group meetings in August and October, and followed up by phone with those who had additional questions and comments. In addition to the verbal comments received during the work group meetings, 4 sets of written comments were submitted by the September 4th deadline. These comments, along with Air District responses, can be found in Attachment C of the staff report. Based on the feedback received, the following are proposed updates to the policies in order to streamline the program and to maximize air quality benefits. Staff is recommending to remove the publicly accessible requirement for alternative fuel infrastructure, which would remove barriers to placing infrastructure at challenging key locations such as multifamily dwelling units. To increase the cost effectiveness limit for EV charging stations at locations with limited charging infrastructure, such as multifamily dwelling units, transit stations, and park and ride lots. To create a new pilot trip reduction project category to allow funding for eligible new emerging mobility project types. And a proposal to allow vehicle replacement of a heavy-duty vehicle weight class with a lighter vehicle weight class. Attachment A of the staff report contains the updated policies, and Attachment B shows the red line updates to the current year's policies. And finally, we'll continue to coordinate with the county program managers on additional suggestions for future cycles. For example, we will continue working on evaluating opportunities to raise the cost effectiveness limit for projects. We will also continue reviewing options to improve the policies to ensure projects are completed within the required 2-year timeframe. And the county program managers express interest in funding emerging mobility project types, so we will work with them to develop methodologies for evaluating these new project types. So that concludes the proposed updates to the fiscal year ending 2020 policies. Now I will move on to the second item of this presentation, which is a policy waiver request by the San Francisco County Transportation Authority for your consideration. Policy 3 allows county program managers to seat board.
Thank you. Director Mitchell.
Thank you. Since you're moving into the next thing, I want to go back to the both the summary and the next steps. And I'm sorry to be the it's the old words matter issue. When I read increased cost effectiveness limit, those sort of an oxymoron. Is it more a threshold? In other words, they have to meet a certain threshold before they can get this?
Yes, and what we're doing is we're raising the threshold. And you're right, it's an awful Sort of holdover that the language has sort of been baked in over the years.
So can you change it to either threshold or some? It's by law.
No. It's just
Damien's
language
saying
that we've.
No, when you're saying yes.
The principle is by law that we have to have it. What we call it, we can refer to it to. That's internal.
I just think
we can
the public,
change that name.
I mean,
that's
as soon
feedback.
As I saw it, I had to stop and think. And
yep.
Okay. Thank you.
Threshold. Thank you.
Director Kim, did you want to jump in on this?
Yeah, I'm still confused. So are we making it tougher or easier for apartments to get funding?
Easier.
Okay. my other question, regarding that first requirement, removing the requirement that infrastructure be available to the public. It ought to be available to the public, but I understand you don't want to make it a requirement. Will a project that does have access to the public get bonus points?
So that's an interesting question. And what happens is we are already offering the funding at the limit. So the only way to offer more money to folks that are offering charging to the public would be to lower the amount available to everybody else. So what we're really just doing is providing the maximum amount of funding because we recognize that it, in some cases, it isn't enough. So we don't want to sort of artificially change those things. But we do offer additional funding for DC fast chargers that are located at transportation corridors because we assume that they'll be used more often than ones that are in other locations. We're evaluating that to see whether that assumption is true. So really the bottom line is the amount of funding that is offered, Damien said, on a flat level, it's not something that needs to be calculated on a per project basis because there's so much uncertainty. So we've sort of done all the engineering on the back end. We offer a flat amount for each kind of project, and that way there's certainty about what funding is available. And we have historically tried to provide the maximum amount of funding at every opportunity.
So I understand. In an effort to spread the money around more, it's more about bang for the buck, but one of the consequences could be that there's slightly less publicly accessible fueling?
For what it's worth, it has been the majority of the funding that has been applied for is publicly accessible charging. And part of that is because we had this requirement that it had to be publicly accessible. So that made it very difficult to install in multifamily dwelling and workplaces, which is where we, you know, so it's this chicken and egg thing. But we will be monitoring the situation, and if we feel that the funds aren't cleaning the air the way that they're intended to, we certainly would go back with recommendations to make further updates.
Go ahead.
Okay. So I will now move on to the second item, which is a policy waiver request by the San Francisco County Transportation Authority. So policy 3 allows the county program managers to seek board approval on a case-by-case basis for projects that do not meet board adopted policies. The current year policies allow funding for charging stations that are only publicly accessible and available. We realize that this requirement can hinder charging station deployment at key sites such as multifamily dwelling units or car sharing locations. And we have proposed to remove this requirement from the fiscal year ending 2020 policies. The project conforms to the health and safety code, and the board adopted TFCA cost effectiveness. So we are recommending this waiver to allow funding for the installation of 2 level 2 charging stations in San Francisco for exclusive use by a electric car sharing fleet. So in conclusion, staff requests that the committee recommend the board of directors, 1, approve the proposed fiscal year ending 2020 TFCA County Program Manager Fund policies, and 2, approve a policy waiver to allow the San Francisco County Transportation Authority to use fiscal year ending 2019 TFCA County Program Manager funds for an EV charging station project. And that concludes my presentation. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Objection to the motion. Motion will pass without objection. Thank you. Give me a second. It's the problem with using an iPad. Item 7.
Good morning. I'd like to introduce Ms. Laura Caquette. She's a member of the Rural Development Section, and she's been working with her colleague, Misha Nishiki, on reviewing and commenting on a proposed rule by the US EPA and the National Transportation Highway Administration. The proposal is Safe Cars, which is an attempt by the Trump administration to roll back progressive CAFE standards or fuel economy standards adopted by the Obama administration, working with California, and also to pull California waivers, which allows the state to adopt tailpipe standards for GHGs and EVs. Laura?
Good morning, Chair Hagerty and members of the committee. As Victor introduced, I'm here this morning to provide an update on the proposed Safer, Affordable, Fuel Efficient, or SAFE vehicles rule, which is the Trump administration's attempt to roll back fuel efficiency regulations. In this presentation, I will give some background context, provide an overview of the Safe Vehicles Rule joint proposal, go over the proposed changes to national fuel economy and greenhouse gas standards, and discuss the controversy around the California waiver. I'll then update you on actions the Air District has already taken and the next steps. As this is a joint proposal, I should note the distinction between the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA, which has authority to set fuel economy or miles per gallon standards for vehicle manufacturers, and EPA, which has authority to set standards for greenhouse gas or CO2 equivalent emissions from new vehicles. NHTSA has been tasked with setting corporate average fuel economy or CAFE standards since 1975, and EPA has been tasked with setting greenhouse gas standards since 2007, when the Supreme Court ruled that it was EPA's responsibility to regulate carbon dioxide as a pollutant under the Clean Air Act. Through most of history, the state of California and the federal government have had different tailpipe standards, with California's being more stringent. In 2012, under the Obama administration, California and the federal government agreed to align their requirements in order to have one national standard. So EPA adopted criteria pollutant and greenhouse gas standards that were the same as those in California's Advanced Clean Cars program, which was adopted at the state level in the same year, 2012. Since the rules package from that agreement covered out to model year 2025, regulators built in a provision to have a midterm review to determine whether the standards were still appropriate. The midterm review analysis was completed in 2016, and the standards were determined to be sustainable. But in 2017, the Auto Alliance sent a letter to the Trump administration asking them to reopen the midterm review. So as a result, we have the Safe Vehicles Rule, which was jointly proposed with NHTSA as the lead, and that was published on August 24th, 2018. The proposed rule would freeze standards for both passenger cars and light trucks at 2020 levels and withdraw the California waiver. The freeze I mentioned means that there would be no increase in stringency for 6 years. NHTSA's part of the proposal involves rolling back their already adopted model year 2021 standards. And since NHTSA adopts CAFE standards in 5-year increments, extending that freeze out for model years 2022 through 2026. EPA is proposing amendments that roll back already adopted greenhouse gas standards for model year 2021 through 2025 and extend that freeze out to model year 2026. So this table shows the inaugural standards that are on the books and the changes that the Safe Vehicles Rule proposes. As you can see, looking out to 2025, which is the second to last row on the table, when you compare the current with the proposed, The proposal puts forward a fuel economy standard that is more than 17 miles per gallon less efficient. And for carbon dioxide in 2025, the proposal would allow 47% more greenhouse gas pollution in terms of grams per mile. A major issue with this proposal is that it would take away the California waiver. California standards were first established in 1966, which predates the Clean Air Act of 1970. When the Clean Air Act was adopted, California's authority to set their own new motor vehicle emission standards, separate from the national standards, was left in place. It's the only state that can do so. Section 177, however, of the Clean Air Act allows other states to adopt California's in lieu of federal standards. 12 states and the District of Columbia are Section 177 states. And together with California, that's over a third of the national car market. The current waiver was granted by EPA in 2013 for all of California's Advanced Clean Cars package, which included criteria pollutant and greenhouse gas tailpipe standards and a zero-emission vehicle mandate. In its history, EPA has granted over 50 waivers and denied only one, a decision which was ultimately reversed by the Obama administration. The Clean Air Act states that the EPA shall grant a waiver unless the administrator finds that California was arbitrary and capricious in its determination that its standards are, in the aggregate, at least as protective of public health and welfare as federal standards, or does not have compelling and extraordinary conditions that necessitate having their own standards, or is not consistent with requirements of Section 202A of the Clean Air Act, which means that the general compliance procedures are the same as EPA and that other conditions like technical feasibility and safety are met. This proposal argues that the California waiver is preempted by EPCA, the Energy Policy and Conservation Act, stating that greenhouse gas standards are de facto fuel economy standards. However, withdrawing an already granted waiver would be an unprecedented action, and EPA has never before tried to do so. If adopted, the proposal would cause a host of harmful impacts. In terms of air quality, there'd be an increase in criteria pollutants from fuel refining and distribution. Additional reductions from stationary sources may be needed to help offset that. All of this would create a need for additional efforts to achieve attainment. In terms of climate effects, there would be an increase in greenhouse gas emissions. Temperatures would continue to rise, which would increase wildfires and therefore particulate matter, sea level rise, and the formation of ozone. Economically, Bay Area residents alone would end up spending $2.3 billion more at the pump to fuel their vehicles if this rule were adopted. The Air District has been taking action since learning of this proposal. There was a public hearing in Fresno, California on September 24th, and Mr. Broadbent gave testimony in opposition to the proposed rule and withdrawal of the California waiver. We also put together a formal comment letter, which I believe you all have, and submitted it to the EPA and NHTSA dockets, reiterating our opposition. For next steps, although the proposed rule has not yet been adopted, the final rule is expected in the spring of 2019. If adopted, the Attorney General and CARB have committed to bring a lawsuit forward, and the Air District will take appropriate action, such as filing an amicus brief or joining as a plaintiff in the litigation. That concludes my presentation. Thank you. If there are any questions, I'm happy to take them.
Director Canepa.
Thank you very much. That was a pretty uplifting presentation. Thank you. Really uplifting. Let me ask you, getting to the waiver, I'm curious, what state had applied for the waiver under the Obama administration? And then what was the reason for the denial of the waiver? And maybe that's a, let me direct this, sorry, I had to have Brian work today. Maybe I should direct it to Mr. Bunger. Mr. Bunger.
So as Laura said, only California can apply for a waiver. It's under Section 209, and that authority was preserved because California had predated EPA's authority over vehicle emissions. So this is one of those areas. It's not just one. It's probably one of the best. It's a little bit complicated. So NHTSA sets these CAFE standards, but EPA actually sets tailpipe standards for motor vehicles. Except if California is granted a waiver, those are the applicable standards in the country. So we, in this particular waiver, the one that was denied, was the one that would have implemented the Pavley bill standards. And so if I'm recalling it correctly, I think that was in 2008. California had actually adopted a rule, requested the waiver. The Bush administration basically opposed that on the ground that setting greenhouse gas tailpipe standard was tantamount to setting a CAFE standard, a vehicle miles per gallon standard. That issue, I believe, was litigated, but ultimately everything in the litigation was resolved when the Obama administration decided to grant the waiver for this joint program. So California and the feds aligned their standards at that point, and those are the ones that roll out through 2025. And so so we're at the tail end of that history at this point. We're in the middle, I should say, because this rule is there, and then there will certainly be litigation. California has actually already filed litigation in this rule development process on an earlier determination related to whether or not the standards were appropriate. And so their argument on that is that was not premature, because without that action, they couldn't have proceeded to the present rule proposal. That has yet to be litigated, although that case has stayed right now pending the rule process. So our letter will give us standing to participate in the litigation if we need to, and that's sort of what we're getting ourselves along by. And I don't know that Laura knows or if it's been completed yet, but we're also signing on to the National Association of Clean Air Agencies comment letter, which goes into more depth on some of the issues. And I know South Coast has an extensive letter coming in. So there's, and California does as well. So there's a number of parts moving forward in California on this topic. Did I get everything you wanted to know?
You did. One last thing. I just want to say, so a lot of it may depend on who the next administration is, or if the current administration stays as it is. It seems to kind of dictate what the policy is moving forward, I would assume, or the adjustment in policy, right?
Yes, I think that's absolutely correct. And another thing that I'm not sure we made as clear as perhaps we should is that it's not as though this technology doesn't exist. The technology to achieve the 2025 standard is already in place, and it's feasible. And so we're not talking about something here that's pushing technology forward. Incremental modifications get you where you need to go. And so this rule really is saying, take feasible technology off the road.
Yeah, because it saves money.
And in fact, the auto industry, to a certain extent, is now lamenting that they asked, because they already have all of this in place. And at this point in the development cycle, the 2025 models are already engineered. We're not talking about something that, you know, that you do, you know, the month before you make the model release. They had asked for some modification, but they weren't asking for a total withdrawal of all of this.
Director Kim?
So that actually ties into what I was going to ask is, it's 2018. Auto manufacturers need to know what they need to pump out.
Yeah.
Now, if we do sue, what judge, who resolves this? I mean, is it a federal judge that is not going to change with any new administration? And then secondly, there are, what, 12, 13 states that are also getting a waiver. Can they also join the suit?
And have. Yeah, they're already involved in the litigation, but and they, of course, will join the next part of it. So the answer to your question is it's filed in the D.C. Circuit, which is the court that hears appeals of final federal action at that level. And so to some extent, it's judges that have already been appointed. They're Article III judges, so they're lifetime appointments. But one of those judges was just elevated to the Supreme Court, and there may be another vacancy
in
the D.C. Circuit
at
this point. So there may be judges that aren't yet sitting who would hear the case to answer that question.
Dr. Mitchell.
Thank you. I am very impressed by this table on slide 5. And I appreciate Mr. Bunger going through the issues that car dealers or manufacturers are already planning years ahead. So it's just inconceivable to me that this administration can say this. I'm in my soapbox period of comment here. this is a good thing, especially when you think in 2025 there's going to be that many more people driving cars. So it is, even though they're proposing 37 miles per gallon, it just is beyond measure. Back to Civics 101. Once a governmental agency makes a decision, that doesn't have to go to Congress to be approved. It stands and then it goes through litigation. It can't, but Congress doesn't get to say yay or nay.
Well, that's right. I mean, So this is one of the authorities that's granted to EPA and NHTSA under the Federal Clean Air Act and also the highway. There's a whole body of law on the highway.
Where the president gets to dictate, whoever the president is.
Right. Just like when we pass a regulation, it doesn't have to go back through the legislature to be approved.
Okay.
There are mechanisms for oversight that, as you may be aware, are being less than stringently adhered to. At the present time, although that doesn't have to last forever. And also, of course, Congress could step in and fix the problem legislatively. That seems highly unlikely in the environment we're operating in. It's actually been unlikely for decades, ever since 1990.
Right, because we only have 53 Congress people, and then there's the rest of the country.
Right, and ever since, yes, but also there's a real tension in the Clean Air Act that since 1990, the politics have just not aligned to address it. Everybody is concerned that something they have there would be removed or changed. And so there's just
so they don't
never
open
been
it up at all.
Any momentum to open up the Clean Air Act.
Well, let's
Air
hope
Act.
It gets resolved at D.C. level and doesn't get moved up to the Supreme Court. Thank you for letting
me use my I suspect that's where we're headed, unfortunately.
Chairman Hudson.
I'm looking at page 207 of this letter you wrote to Wheeler and King. Don't get as involved with EPA as NHTSA from transportation issues. And I can tell you what a joy it is sitting in a meeting with NHTSA. They're always with their arms folded, which is we're going to say no. Two things caught my attention. Freezing them at 2020 levels would threaten our ability to fulfill our responsibilities on multiple levels. Probably going to have something in writing that explains what that is to them, what the multiple levels are, or whatever, because there seems to be this preemptive, we don't care what California wants, we're looking at everybody else. But the other one is direct impacts. Any action by the agency that would lead to an increase in emissions of our air pollutants would hinder the air district's efforts to deliver clean air to the more than 7 million residents who live here. I go back to when we were talking about cap and trade, and it kept going, oh, we got to cap it. Well, if we're going to 90% electric vehicles in 2050, you would think somewhere down the road, even at 2025, factoring in what the new electric vehicles are, that these numbers would be less. Where I'm going with this is if we lose this thing, which seems to take years to get to where we're talking about going, I mean, is there the alternative fallback of diesel-free in 33, diesel-free in 27? Or, I mean, have we thought about that?
There's a lot bound up in that. So diesel free in 33 is, of course, a voluntary effort, and this wouldn't affect that. I mean, in theory, vehicles that could be used in that domain would be available. They just wouldn't be mandated. This didn't mandate those kind of vehicles anyway. The diesel vehicle sector, I mean, there are some diesel passenger vehicles and all that, but that's not a very large sector of the types of vehicles involved here. There are some in the pickup classes and those kind of things, but, you know, for passenger vehicles, far and away more gasoline-powered and advanced technology vehicles. So on the EV side, though, withdrawing the waiver would affect the ZEV mandate, the zero-emission vehicle mandate that California has, the modified form anyway. And so that's one of the strong concerns.
Thanks, Brian. I was trying to find a silver lining in this somewhere.
Yeah, we can still move forward with things that aren't mandated. But also there's some one of the things that underlies all of these regulatory programs, there's this averaging, which is the corporate average fuel economy. So not every single vehicle meets exactly the same standard, but across the fleet that you sell, you have to hit the average, which means that you're basically your vehicles are across the spectrum anyway. And including sales, better. There's also trading of credits involved in that, so that manufacturers like Tesla, whose corporate average fuel economy is essentially infinite, can sell their they sell those credits in the marketplace, so others can comply by there's a credit trading program in essence for vehicle miles. This proposal, one of the things it does is it messes around with those mechanisms, which is also deleterious to getting to better vehicles. So, I mean, there's a number of pieces at play here, all of which are not good.
Well, one of the, Brian, do you want to just mention, so if we did sue, is there a possibility of us actually forestalling the changes until the lawsuit is resolved?
Yes, there are stay mechanisms available. In general, during challenges, the courts are supposed to maintain the status quo. Which, in this case, if you look at, and it's sort of on the greenhouse gas side where this is more obvious, but it applies on both. Look at where the current tracks are. So if you look at the current CAFE standard in 2018 is 38.3. Well, that's already more than the proposed one for 2020. And so that's the status quo. That can be done today. And in fact, 2019 models are already in dealer showrooms, and the 2020s are finishing up their development cycle. I mean, and for some vehicles, they're actually further out than that. So all of that can already is being and can still be done. That's the status quo, would be the argument. And the same thing applies if you go over to the greenhouse gas standard, the grams per mile limits. You see that they're rolling back to something between 2018 and 2019 standard when they get to 2020 with the proposal. So those can already be accomplished and are being built today. And so that the argument would be that is the status quo, and the court should preserve that as they go forward. So at least we wouldn't slide backwards during the course of the litigation. The court might also say, we're going to let whatever the standards in place are now roll forward while we take a look at whether this was appropriate.
Anybody else? Okay, so that was an update. So go to public comment, a time in which you can speak to anything that's not on today's agenda. Marcia has no cards. Next meeting appears to be December 17th, but as you know, that tends to bounce around. So on all these happy notes, I would announce this adjournment.
Now that we're done, one of the things that was on here was the update of the shuttle for the Peninsula Corridor. Can we get some kind of an update of where they are with the Peninsula Corridor? I mean, we wrote letters to D.C. and the electrification.
Caltrain electrification? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, thanks.